All right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Journey Home with Lynn Johnson and Bruce Rawls. And Bruce is here with me on Skype on the phone, and I'm going to turn the mic over to you, Bruce, and let you say what's going on with you while I go check the microphone or check the recording. So, Bruce Rawls.
Sure.
Good morning, Bruce.
Hi, Lynn and all. I don't have a whole lot of news other than my usual recommendation for anybody who, for some strange reason, may not have found these two websites, to check out acim.org and facim.org. And on the latter one, for the Foundation for Foundation for Miracles, which is the organization used to be in Temecula, California, is now in Henderson, Nevada. They have new programs, and Jeffrey is taking those on, and those are now available on the new streaming site that's on the facim.org website. So if you click on streaming on facim.org, you can see a whole new website that has hundreds of videos and audios, and highly recommend going there and setting up a free account, and you'll discover there's more than a half a dozen audio recordings and a bunch of, well, of course, the YouTube channel already has a lot of video, but now there's even more that's being added from the archives. So if you happen to be in the Las Vegas, Nevada area, you can attend the weekly meetings that are being recorded there and now put on the website. But you can also listen online at any time around the world. So highly recommend doing that. And the content that Jeff is doing is just wonderful. And I've listened to all six or seven of them now. Anyway, they're putting one up every week now. So, and plus other longer programs. So highly recommend that. And then, of course, we're continuing to resume work on the Foundation for Inner Peace website, and you can always reach me at acimblog.com. So
very
that's
good.
My kind of usual suggestions for folks wanting to find online resources for the course.
Absolutely, and it's great, and I saw that recording or video of Ken from 1984
Isn't that wonderful?
It was so cool.
Yeah.
But I have, you know, I have a bunch of videotapes, which I am actually going to end up throwing out because, you know, who has a VHS recorder anymore? But I have the whole series of videotapes of Ken from years and years ago, and then also cassette tapes. I have a whole library of cassette tapes of Ken that Billy Diggs sent me. So it's and I did get a cassette, a recorder, something I can transfer to an MP3. So and that's how I've been able to play a lot of the Ken Wapnick that I have. But there is so much. Oh my goodness, what a prolific life. And
absolutely.
What a gift Ken Wapnick has been to us. So very good.
Are these videos, curiously, are they ones that are not on YouTube?
Oh, I'm sure they are, because it's the whole journey through the workbook and all kinds of stuff. I mean, I have to get them out and look at them. I've got so many of them.
Okay, yeah. Because we still have a VHS machine, at least I have access to one, that I think still works.
I might pack them up and ship them out.
Okay.
All right, good idea. Okay, so we are reading the book, The Journey Home, The Obstacles to Peace and the Course in Miracles by Dr. Kenneth Wapnick. And I think we're doing pretty well. We're kind of slugging around.
We're on through page 40, as I reckon.
Woohoo!
So.
And it's only March, so. but very, very well worth all of it. And I have us leaving off, I guess it must be page 40, maybe where a little barrier of sand still
exactly.
stands between you and your brother?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, you want to read or you want me to read?
I'll start in.
Okay.
Okay. So it begins with a quote from the Course, as often does, and then with Ken's commentary after that. Anyway, the first paragraph is, the little barrier of sand... I'll start that again. The little barrier of sand still stands...
Jesus.
The little barrier of sand still stands between you and your brother. Would you reinforce it now? You are not asked to let it go for yourself alone. Christ asks it of you for himself. The, quote, little barrier of sand, end quote, is our anger or attack thoughts, the symbol for the separation or gap we believed existed in the original separation from God. We can understand this barrier in two ways. The first is exactly what the text is saying, that the desire to hold on to our peace or let go of our little barrier of sand is done for Christ's sake, literally. Christ asks it of us so that he can find his home in us. In other words, he cannot be at home in us unless we invite him in. He certainly is at home in our true self, capital S self, because that is Christ. But we have drawn a curtain of individuality and guilt around it, protected by our projections of attack. Secondly, as we have seen in other places in A Course in Miracles, releasing our anger is being asked of us for all people. The lesson, quote, when I'm healed, I'm not healed alone, end quote, which is workbook lesson 137, echoes this same theme. God's Son is one, Christ, and if we exclude but a single person from the sonship, we have destroyed the whole and crucified Christ once again. And since we are part of Christ, we must have crucified ourselves as well, which indeed is what the entire world of time and space bears witness to, pain, suffering, and death. Thus, Jesus is making the point that if we really knew what we were doing by holding on to our grievances against others, attacking ourselves, we would no longer seek to justify or reinforce our anger, and thus we would let it go. So, a whole lot in that paragraph, huh?
Boy, no kidding. Pretty much everything you need to know about what's going on and what we need to do.
I
was looking at today's lesson, and it kind of this is what we're practicing today. And the lesson is this healing of ourselves and our brothers through forgiveness, which is, obviously every lesson is about that. But
and the function that we don't want to forget.
And the function that we don't want to forget, yeah. So the light of the world brings peace to every mind through my forgiveness. It brings peace to mm-hmm. every mind through my forgiveness.
Not just a few. Yeah.
Not just a few. And so there's two things in the lesson. I mean, there's so much in this lesson. But the ways that we apply the lesson, and one is says through my forgiveness, I can see this as it is, and then the next lesson it says this may threaten my ego, but it cannot change my function in any way. So it all comes down to remembering the truth. And, every time we have a problem or an issue or an upset, all we have to do is remember the truth of who you are. And, once you remember the truth of what you are and what your brother is, then you can't be changed. You are whole. And I was talking about it earlier with a group we're all talking about this needs to be fixed and that needs to be fixed. And I thought about the word fixed, and I realize, if you are, like, if you're in astrology and you were one of the fixed signs, that means that you are set and you cannot change. You know, it's fixed in place. Or if a person is, in a coma or something and their eyes are fixed, It means that they can't be moved. They're not moving.
When static.
Static. Yeah. When something is fixed, it is there. It's permanent. It's whole. And so you know that this is what happens. You can't be moved by the world. You can't be moved by the plight of the body or the you know anything else. Because you are already fixed. When I'm healed, I'm not healed alone. I mean, it just goes perfectly with the today's lesson, so coincidentally.
Yeah, it's a timeless, changeless peace that we're being reinvited back to. I also like in this last paragraph I just read that he actually kind of touches on the double shield of oblivion. He says, we have drawn a curtain of individuality and guilt around it, protected by our projections of attack. Well, the curtain of individuality and guilt, of course, is the thought system of the ego, of the belief in separation. And in order to protect, further seem to protect, that's obviously very vulnerable to erosion from the truth, we made up a whole universe. You know, we projected an entire cosmos and that was with the intent of hiding from the truth, hiding from peace, hiding from our real innocence. And how crazy is that, huh?
Yeah, I mean that's our whole raison d'être here for this, the way that we do things in the world is
or our grape d'être before it shrivels up. Right?
Oh my gosh! Yes, our great Tetra. Add some water, and you got a raisin again. not quite as it doesn't have the same turgor. So, but you know this whole paragraph is talking about the connectedness and the responsibility, and you know that's you know it's unfair to expect responsibility from someone or something that is not capable of being responsible. And so, you know, we go through our lives thinking, I'm not capable of being responsible for all this. You know, how could I be possibly be responsible for the war in Syria? Or how could I possibly be responsible for my neighbor, you know, having a difficulty? Or how could I possibly be responsible? You know, Jesus isn't saying we're responsible for the situations and the story. We're responsible for our thoughts about the situation and the story, and
exactly.
Our thoughts about the brothers, the individuals who appear to be in the situation and the story. And again, that's why today's lesson has a little fill in the blanks, so that you can you can look at, you know, here's, you know, what does it say? Let peace extend from my mind to yours, fill in the blank. I share the thought of the world, the light of the world with you, fill in the blank. And so anybody or anything that comes up, we can fill in the blank and include that person, place, or thing or idea in our forgiveness. And it doesn't matter what it is or who it is. When we fill the blank in, we recognize that it's all interchangeable. It's all the same.
Exactly. And we're all the same by extrapolation or interpolation. So if we're all the same, that means that everyone merits kindness. In fact, the other day I was thinking about some of the ads for the, you know, sports cars and things like that. You know, we talked about, you know, like some of the new electric cars, like the Tesla and whatnot. They, you know, 0 to 60 in so many seconds, right? And I was thinking, the Holy Spirit's version of that might be 0 to a call for love in 2 seconds, which is, you know, when we recognize something and we're tempted to have condemning thoughts or thoughts that are less than recognition of the perfect oneness and the perfect innocence of all creation, which is to say that, you know, if we assess anyone as having or being less than all of spirit, you know, we're selling ourselves short. And so it's how quickly we can, you know, let go of that. You know, it's sort of like our, not that it's a numbers game, but it's almost like a performance metric, is if we can kind of catch ourselves more quickly. You know, so how about zero to a call for love in 2 seconds, you know, or 0 seconds when we, you know, that, really practice this.
Right? That's a pretty dynamic vehicle.
Yeah.
Yeah. if you think
but our mind is pretty dynamic, so with practice, we can, instead of, you know, immediately, you know, reflexively condemning, we can reflexively forgive. And that, I think that's what's being asked, is that we've learned with practice to do that.
Practice, and we'll get someplace beyond Carnegie Hall. So
exactly.
I love it. All right, so I'm going to read. He would bring peace to everyone. And how can he do this except through you? You know, that's quite a little enigma, isn't it? He would bring peace to everyone. And how can he do that except through you? You know, and I'm saying, who, me? I don't get that. It is the same idea you find in Lesson 186. Salvation of the world depends on me. Salvation or peace must begin with me because I am everyone. This quote-unquote I, as we know, is not our individual persona, but the quote-unquote I that is Christ.
And that's a good place to remind ourselves that A Course in Miracles, as all of Ken's writing, really, and you know, any other work that is, you know, aligned with what A Course in Miracles is all about, will be addressed to always and only about the mind, but in particular the decision-making faculty of the mind, because what we really are in truth is the Christ. But in order to return to that, the decision-making faculty of what we are has to let go of choosing against that, and that's what we hear says, overcoming the obstacles to peace, by recognizing that moment to moment, we can shift our identity from a silly, seemingly separate self to a real identity that has nothing to do with limitation, but has everything to do with what we truly share, and that's the I that is the Christ.
That's it, exactly. So would you let a little bank of sand, a wall of dust, a tiny seeming barrier, stand between your brothers and salvation? That's a huge question that Jesus is asking. You know, and we think that it is so meaningful, but really, you know, it seems like, you know, what is this little barrier, this tiny wall of dust? What is that thing? And I know I've gone into lots and lots and lots of conversations with people about what is this tiny barrier, this little bank of sand. And really, all it is just the idea that you and I have separate and different motivations, different needs, and so letting go of that different, separate motivation, that different, separate need, is essential in order to be able to grasp what is going on here. So he says, now, Ken says, now the trick is when you really feel yourself angry at someone and the fury rages up inside of you, to then think of these phrases: a little bank of sand, a wall of dust, a tiny seeming barrier. Which is another way of saying that the fury is nothing, just as the thought of separation is nothing more than a tiny mad idea. Similarly, the section entitled The Two Worlds talks about clouds of guilt being unsubstantial, even though it seems that at the moment of our experience of self-hatred, that what we are feeling is quite real. From the battleground of our world, hatred hardly seems inconsequential. what is referred to in chapter 27 as sin's quote-unquote heavy consequences. However, when we raise ourselves above the battleground, the decision maker in our minds, where we can observe our egos with Jesus beside us, then we can see the thought of attack for what it really is. Nothing but a little bank of sand, which has no power to affect anything at all. And so once again, Jesus is asking us to weigh the personal cost of our holding on to our thoughts of judgment and attack against the glorious rewards that forgiveness would bring us. You know, I'm just thinking, you know, I always go of this little bank of sand, this little bank of dust, and I always think, you know, it's hard for me to think about what that is. But then I'm thinking about, and also think, you know, he uses these terms because it was Helen's experience that was being drawn on here. And so, you know, it must have had some meaning to Helen, this idea of a bank of sand or a bank of dust, you know, that she had seen in her lifetime that she recognized made something inconsequential. And so for me, I always think about it as when you're, this cracked me up, when I'm sweeping the floor and I get a little bank of dust, I've actually built up a little pile of dust, and sometimes, you know, cat hair and all that other stuff too, included.
Oh, yeah. we know that story well.
Always.
That's most of what I emptied from the vacuum.
I know. You can build a whole cat out of my vacuum cleaner every day. No. Seems like, but because we have five, so. But I think about that, and every time I'm sweeping, if I use the broom to sweep, you know, I think there's that little bank of sand. That's what, you know, Jesus is talking about. It's not like, you know, I'm at the beach and there's a bank of sand in front of me, or, you know, it's not like, it's like I'm here in my kitchen and here's this little bank of sand. And, you know, it's nothing. I can just sweep it into the dustbin and it is gone. Anyway, just a thought there.
Well, interesting. I was just thinking of the double entendre of bank, and you know, it also could be an investment. You know, it could be where we what we value. You know, and we certainly value the body and all the things that happen or don't happen to it. It's planes. I'm doing tongue twister stuff this morning. Pains and pleasures, you know, that we think are different, as the Course suggests. Last night we watched a movie that a neighbor loaned us that had been sitting there for months. We found out, let's watch this movie. We'd seen it before. It was about 20 years ago. Called Dangerous Beauty, and it's about a courtesan in Venice and her persecution by the Inquisition later in the film, and how basically the resolution was that everyone in the community that had been her clientele basically came forward and let her off the hook during this religious Inquisition kind of thing. But you know, the whole premise was you know, what the body does or doesn't do is important, and, you know, special love, special hate. And it was just like a tour de force of all of that kind of stuff. So I just was watching it with amusement and seeing how, you know, that's what we do in this world. Everything is a big freaking deal, and we make judgments and condemnations about, you know, little banks of dust. And we wage wars. Part of the film was you know, going, you know, getting reinforcements from another country to you know, wage war against yet another country, and you know, it's like, well, how crazy is this world, you know, this tiny mad idea where we find the need, you know, in our investments in duality to defend little banks of dust against things that seem to happen to them, and you know, obviously it's just the, you know, the the nuts and bolts of everyday life, but if we can kind of remember that it's a tiny mad idea and just just, you know, learn to not take it quite so seriously. There's a whole lot more peace that's beyond that craziness, isn't it?
It is, and it's, I don't know why I was thinking about this, but the old joke that from dust thou art and to dust thou shalt return, and then someone saying, you know, have you looked under your bed, because there's either somebody coming or going.
That's good.
But that's it. It's dust. That's pretty funny. Okay.
We're hanging out on top of our cupboards.
We're hanging out on top of our cupboards. Okay. Let's see. So, let's see. Did I read this? And yet this little remnant of attack you cherish still against your brother is the first obstacle to peace in the peace encounters in you in its going forth. This little wall of hatred will still oppose the will of God and keep it limited. Of course, that's from the obstacles to peace. To whatever, and Ken says, to whatever extent we choose to hate or attack someone, then at that moment, peace will disappear from us. In the section on what is the peace of God in the Manual for Teachers, we read, and this is from the Manual for Teachers, God's peace can never come where anger is, for anger must deny that peace exists. Who sees anger as justified in any way or any circumstance proclaims that peace is meaningless and must believe that it cannot exist. In this condition, peace cannot be found. And then, of course, you know, we can't find peace where you're expecting it not to be. And so Ken says, and so when we cherish our individuality over the peace of God, anger becomes the final defense. Again, the sequence of the ego's defenses is that we first make up our guilt to drive us from our minds. Then we make up a world of specifics that we can hate in the body to shield us from the guilt we have first made real in our minds.
There's the devil's shield of oblivion. Very clearly explained. Huh?
Exactly. Very clear. So let's just go through that again. The sequence of the ego's defenses is that we make up our guilt to drive us from our minds, then make up the world so that we can hate in the body, and that is to shield us from the guilt that we have made first real in our minds. And so this idea of guilt, which I know so many people throughout the years since I've been studying A Course in Miracles have said completely honestly, without any thought at all, I don't feel guilty. I don't know what this guilt that Jesus is talking about is. I don't feel guilty. And it's so opposite from my experience, Bruce, because I do feel guilty every time I see a hungry child, every time I see, you know, somebody, you know, a child being mistreated, every time I see global warming causing all these horrible storms and people are, you know, drowning in Nebraska and in Zimbabwe or wherever, that there's, every time I see something wrong in the world, I feel intense guilt. I feel intense guilt because I feel like I should have stopped that. I have the ability to make that not happen. I need to do something so that it doesn't happen anymore. I feel intense guilt. That's what motivates me to do many of the things I do. Give to charity, hand $20 to a homeless guy, sign a petition, write a Facebook post, you know, all of those things, you know, cook my family dinner, you know, oh my gosh, you know, you're going to suffer and starve if I'm not here to feed you. You know, I feel responsible. I feel guilty if I don't. Maybe I burned your eggs. Oh man, now I feel double guilty. You know, I mean, I see nothing in the world but an excuse for guilt everywhere I look. So I don't have that question, you know, I don't feel guilty. I know how guilty I feel.
Well, you may just be, you know, more tuned, but I think to in response to those who, you know, share what you shared that, you know, you've heard and I've heard as well, I would say that if guilt isn't the word that triggers the awareness of the need to be vigilant for the ego, then how about lack of peace? Because I think just about anybody, if they're honest with themselves, would say, do you, if they asked, you know, do you feel peaceful 100% of the day, would have to say, no, of course not. In fact, you know, the more honest answer was the moments of true, all-encompassing peace that we feel during the typical day is either nil or close to it. Because there's always something that's like, oh, well, I need to do this, or I'm concerned about that, or I should have done that, or, you know, some aspect of concern for the world, which is the outer shield of oblivion, which is really a mask for the, where Ken says here, the inner shield, which is we make up guilt, we make up a whole thought system of separation that is based on the belief in sin, guilt, and fear as the mechanisms by which we have made up separate selves. And that, of course, drives us from our minds because that's an intolerable state relative to the peace that is our true nature. And so these are the obstacles. You know, the double shield really is, you know, the obstacles to peace, and, you know, phrased in a different way.
Absolutely. And so yeah, there's... It's no mystery to me. Absolutely no mystery to me. So let's see. Do you want to read now?
Sure. Okay. So after Ken really gives a nice short summary of this double shield of oblivion, he says the first of the three steps of forgiveness, which I have discussed at other times, is to say, "I quote, I'm not angry at you. I'm really angry at myself." Unquote. In other words, the guilt is brought from the outside in the body of another to the inside back to our minds. This is the same idea that is expressed in this first obstacle to peace. Thus, the first obstacle is that we are still choosing to let this little wisp of a nothing, which is a projection of our guilt, stand between our brother and ourselves. So rather than seeing the projection as a little wisp of nothing, we see it instead as a solid wall of granite, which then becomes the means of our justifying our anger. In our minds, we say, this person has done something that is so terrible that I can never be friends with him or her again. With or without Spanish Inquisition, right? Or whatever form the idea takes. And all the while, our hatred of ourselves for the terrible thing we believe we did to God remains safe and protected behind this little wall of hatred. And beyond this is our, quote, sacred, unquote, individuality, whose specialness is now insured seemingly forever. So the specialness really is, the individuality is really, you know, within that inner shield of oblivion, which is the whole realm of the mind, where the ego has free reign. And as long as the specialness and the belief in separation enshrined and protected, we're just in a, you know, green or amber alert, you know, but once we get back to the mind, it goes to red alert. And that's why, of course, says, you no longer are pretending, or the ego is no longer pretending to be your friend because you've threatened its whole thought system once you start looking at the contents of the mind without condemnation. If you can do that, you can see that, you know, now it's pulling out all the stops to get a rise out of us and to make us have the ego knee-jerk reaction of condemnation, attack, blame, anger, that whole realm of stuff that just keeps the projection in place and reinforces the double shield of oblivion.
Yeah, and it's like when you do this, as you were reading this, I was thinking, it just came to my mind a vision of being locked in a tower. You know, these stories that we have about, you know, they locked a person in a tower and they could never come out. That's how it is. It's like you're locked up and you can't ever be free because you are so caught up in your own ideas and belief system about what is. And so the only way to, you know, let go of it is to recognize that you know, this is a little wall of dust. It's not an ivory tower. I'm I think about that song, come down from your ivory tower. You know, that's the whole song is about, you know, somebody putting themselves in a place where they can't be touched and they're in a cold world. This is what happens to us when we decide that judgment is the our way of relating, and that there's, you know, definitely something that needs to be fixed and undone. We put ourselves in a place where we have lost communication, and we're incommunicado, which is not a place in Mexico.
Or something you make guacamole out of.
Yeah, something you make guacamole in incommunicado. I love them things. So, we're the only thing that we're doing is walling ourselves off and preventing ourselves from being able to relate and be in joy. So this is a big deal for us. So you want to keep reading?
Sure. The Holy Spirit's purpose rests in peace with you, yet you are still unwilling to let it join you wholly. That's a W-H-O-L-L-Y, holy. You still oppose the will of God just by a little. And then in brackets, Ken's commentary, which I annotated with a little smiley face on the margins. And Ken says, Jesus is a little optimistic here.
Just a little bit. Says,
just a smidge, just a skosh. And that little is a limit you would place upon the whole. God's will is one, not many. It has no opposition, for there is none beside it. And now Ken's commentary continues. This merely repeats the idea that there is a part of us, and this is a choice on our parts, that is unwilling to let this barrier go. Were we to let the Holy Spirit join us wholly, W-H-O-L-L-Y again, our individuality, which of course has the word duality in it, would disappear. That this is why we all, as the Son, as one Son in that original instant, chose against Him, capital H Him, and for the ego. It is this ontological choice that we reenact over and over and over in our relationships, as we see in this important statement from the text. This is from chapter 26, section 5, paragraph 13. Each day, and every minute in each day, and every instant that each minute holds, you but relive the single instant when the time of terror took the place of love.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And that's I always kind of flash when we get down to the granularity of time and, you know, seconds and intervals within seconds. I kind of flash on something that a lady named Robin McWane, who gave a talk to a group that my wife and I hosted called New Frontiers, the Gold Country in Northern California several decades ago now. And she had been studying modern physics and had a really wonderful evening presentation, largely about that. And she talked about the two Planck constants, one for space and one for time. The one for space is, I think, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. It's just this incredibly small, you know, measurement of distance or space. And the Planck time constant, to me, I found even more fascinating. And her kind of take-home interpretation of it, which I think I haven't seen anything I've read or studied, which isn't very extensive, actually, admittedly, in modern physics arena, that suggests that, you know, the universe may actually be winking in and out of existence 10 to the 44th times per second, because the Planck time constant is 10 to the minus 44, roughly. You know, I forget what the digits are in front of it, but it's roughly that, you know, get within an order of magnitude, which means that there's like a stroboscopic nature. Because it's not real, we have to keep breathing life into it. But because we wanted to make this movie really photorealistic, 3D holographic, you know, so-called reality here, and we didn't want anyone to question it, we made it very, very finely unflickering, you know, holographic movie. And so 10 to the 44th times per second, actually, breathing life back into a dream in order to make it seem real. And we do this all unconsciously, just like our autonomic nervous system and our, you know, biological process in our body do all that stuff without us having to think about it, because of this unconscious sin, guilt, fear, this outer shield of oblivion. We made, part of that is we made this holographic movie so realistic that no one would question it. You know, as Ken points out a lot in his conversations, the most brilliant minds in history haven't stumbled across the fundamental premise that is at the core of undoing the illusion, which is that it's a universe made up of guilt. And so it's literally reinforcing the guilt 10 to the 44th times per second within the context of this dream, and in order to make it so unassailable that, hardly anybody questions it, right? So, anyway.
Yes, and as you were talking about that,
I see the quote. Yeah.
Yeah, I put the whole quote, so because I put the whole quote in the room, but as you were talking about that, I was thinking about it. It is just like a movie. Each individual moment is a still picture. Mm-hmm. Each individual moment that appears to be, so fluid and so moving and so real is really just a still picture and a still picture and a still picture and a still picture. That is, the time is the movement. It's like shining a light on each individual still picture. So you're right. It is stroboscopic. It does go in and out because there is no fluid motion, because there is no reality to it. And that, brings me back to my idea about this world, this illusion being like a museum where each individual exhibit is already set and we're just moving along through the different exhibits and thinking that it is our life and our reality. So, and each room in each exhibit and each, it's a vast illusion, a vast museum. But there is no actual movement because there is no actual life. There is only appearance of movement because the light shining on each individual moment makes it appear that it is moving.
Exactly. We don't see the flickering because it's so fast. I mean, all it takes for our body's eyes to basically erase the sensation of the flickering of the flames, is 30 frames per second or 60, frames per second, in that order of magnitude. And our mind just says, oh, this is a continuously, there's perfect continuity between one and the other, and the time is this now the substance that seems to flow from one thing to the next without any break. But it's all quanta. It's all just little bursts of nothing sewn together in such a way that it appears to have continuity, but it's all just dust particles fabricated from the mind and then reassembled, dismantled and reassembled 10 to the 44th times per second, in order to give us the appearance of, well, this is a big deal. Pay attention here.
So is it dismantled and remantled?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
But it's a cartoon, so it's really just Mickey Mouse mantled.
Right? Mickey Mouse.
For an obscure baseball ball reference.
I knew you'd get something out of that. How funny.
The younger folks to scratch their heads, all right?
Exactly. Speaking of younger folks, I went to a kirtan last night here in town, and it was so cool because everybody that was there basically were, over 50 and probably close to over 60. So that's Pueblo. Our spiritual community here is a little bit old. I think we need to get some younger people involved. But it was wonderful singing with a bunch of people, and I had a great time. But anyway, I'm going to read this quote, the entire quote, not just the line that's in the book, because I think this is helpful to people to have this explanation about time and our seeming lives in this world. Each, this is text chapter 26, section 5, paragraph 13. Each day and every minute in each day and every instant that each minute holds, you but relive the single instant when the time of terror took the place of love. So we're reliving the tiny man idea over and over and over. And so you die each day to live again until you cross the gap between the past and present, which is not a gap at all. Such is each life, a seeming interval from birth to death and on to life again, a repetition of an instant gone by long ago that cannot be relived. And all of time is but the mad belief that what is over is still here and now. This is so hugely informative, you know, to come to understand that is what we think is happening happened long ago. What we think we're facing is over and done. The future we expect is not. There's no future. It's all the past. You know, I mean, we get all these hints. I see nothing but the past. And you think, well, you know, I'm just, yeah, because in the past I knew this was a cup, and now I see it a cup, and I think it is a cup now, too. That's true. But reality is, it's not a cup now. It's a cup that happened during the tiny mad idea long, long ago. And it's not even the same cup. It just is just a flickering of light and an illusion. And you know, I can't even change that. You know, I can't even change what I'm going to say next, because what I'm going to say next was already said a long time ago. I'm not inventing something new. I'm not reading something new. I'm not bringing about a new idea. I'm not opening up a new understanding of things. All I'm doing is reflecting on something that already occurred and making, you know, my emotional thoughts about it. You know, I'm afraid of the future. I'm worried about the past. I'm sorry about this. You know, all I'm doing is bouncing back and forth off of something that is so far gone that there's no way to alter it. You can't change it. You know, you can't change the past. And so all you can do is recognize that it's over and move on. You know, and that's what Jesus is trying to tell us here. But of course, we're still going to try to fix it.
Exactly. So then, are you suggesting the outrageous idea that dust bunnies can only reproduce in dreams?
Yes.
Okay then. Well,
that's right.
Well, with that established, let's move on.
That's right. Now I'm going to dream I'm vacuuming later. So vacuumed earlier. It's all happened already. All right. Let's see. Okay. Our attack thoughts preserve this individuality, hiding behind our terror, and express our unwillingness to let Jesus or the Holy Spirit into our minds. And this line has no opposition, so there is none beside it, is reminiscence of the Course's earlier quoting from the First Commandment, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me," from Exodus. Jesus' response in A Course in Miracles is, "Thou shalt have no other gods before him, because there are none." It is not said as a threat or a demand. It is but a simple statement of a simple fact. And that is a quote from text chapter 26. There can be no other God because there is no other God. All the other gods are just specialness idols of the ego, which do not exist. The same idea is found here. To say God's will is one, not many, is to state that our seeming separate wills are, let's see, this thing does not turn easily, really non-existent. Again, this is another reflection of the non-dualistic nature of the Course's thought system. There is only God's will and there is nothing else. And that is why it is so important always to keep in mind the basic premise of A Course in Miracles. God did not create this world, and there is nothing of him that is in this world. Moreover, Everything of this world speaks of the opposite of him, since it is a world of duality and perception. And here a quote from text chapter 25, God's laws do not obtain directly to a world perception rules, for such a world could not have been created by the large mind, the capital M mind, to which perception has no meaning. Yet are his laws reflected everywhere? Not that the world where this reflection is real at all. And Ken had put that in italics. That the world that is seen, that is appears to be a reflection of grievances and sadness and whatever, that is not real. So God is in everything I see because God is in my mind. God is, you know, people will say, well, yeah, but isn't God in the illusion? No, because the illusion is not real. And God is real. God couldn't be any place that is not real because God is real. So, you know, there are a lot of people that want to try to bring God into the illusion and give the illusion the effects of God and say, you know, this is reflecting God. And you know, no, it's reflecting my egoic thinking. You know, God is in my mind and I can see the egoic thinking that is creating this world. It doesn't exist. I can't put God in it. I can't make God into this chair or another person, or I can't make God into something that God is not. And I know people get really confused about it because, you know, they're thinking, you know, well, love the chair because God's in the chair. No, God is not in that chair, or not in my chair anyway, but but God's in my mind, and that's where, guess what? The chair is too. The chair is in my mind. God is in my mind. So I have to go back to the true causation of this thing that I call chair and realize, you know, this is why all these early lessons are about, you know, what does this thing mean to me? Because what chair means is that I have a butt that needs a chair to sit in. That there is a...
an exception. A butt is an exception.
Right? A butt is an exception. That's right.
To an otherwise flawless statement.
Yes, exactly. So this chair is really a reflection of my belief that I need a freaking chair. Because in heaven there are no chairs. Why?
So it's really true charity to let go of the belief in a separate chair.
Oh my God. Oh, I feel like I've... I don't know what.
Oh, enough wordplay, right?
No, it's not enough wordplay because wordplay is the thing. It's the, you know, this is all a play on words. Every single bit of it is a play on words. That's why all these puns, and that's why, you know, Jesus was a great punster. You know, he put a lot of puns in the course, and if you look at it, you'll find them, because once you recognize that he's always saying that nothing real can be threatened, that nothing unreal exists, then you're going to see anywhere he references something that appears to be unreal, and you're going to find that there's a pun there. There's a tongue-in-cheek kind of a statement that when you reflect on it, you'll recognize, oh, he's saying there is no but in that chair.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there is no chair because there is no but. Oh, my gosh. And we're all in charity. Oh, my gosh. So then from the clarification of terms, he says, the world you see is an illusion of a world. God did not create it, for what he creates must be eternal as himself. It must be fixed. Yet there is nothing in the world you see that will endure forever. Some things will last in time a little longer than others, but the time will come when all things visible will have an end. So that, you know, that we know it's all temporary. Mm-hmm. So then he says, from the obstacles to peace, what would you still contain behind your little barrier and keep separate from your brother? Seems mightier than the universe, for it would hold back the universe and its creator. This little wall would hide the purpose of heaven and keep it from heaven. And again, that's what, you know, that's what we're saying, is that just even perceiving that and experiencing it as real is preventing me from seeing the reality of what's here, which is only love, only God. No need for anything, because nothing, the body doesn't exist, the world doesn't exist, and the mind that thinks that it does doesn't exist. So that's really, you know, where we're going to. And then he says, what you would still contain behind the barrier is guilt. We could also substitute the concept of fear for guilt. In other places, the Course in Miracles says that that peace is behind the barrier. The Course is not the easiest reading, to say the least. And yeah, there's he says a lot of things. And then it seems like he's saying something different later. But
he takes poetic license, but the meaning, the content is always the same.
It's always the same. That's right.
Even the form varies a lot.
Exactly. Absolutely. So, anyway, we're about to the end of our time here.
Yeah. How about if I read one more paragraph to take us to the next page?
That's a great idea.
Okay. Guilt comes from the belief that we have sinned or separated ourselves from God, which means that we have attacked Him and have taken His power and misused it. The fact that we believe we are in a body in the world seems to be the proof that we have accomplished that. Within this world, God is totally absent, which means that this world has the power to keep God away. Well, Prishtu, huh? And what keeps the world going is our guilt, because it is our guilt that prevents us from seeing beyond itself to our decision to be separate and an individual. By the way, here Jesus is using, quote, universe, in quotes, not to mean the physical universe, as he sometimes does elsewhere, but rather as the universe of Christ or heaven. And it all gets back to the idea that, you know, we've made up a universe in order, you know, the outer shield of oblivion, to hide from the place in the mind where the truly unconscious, unfounded guilt lies. But it's unconscious until we get back to the mind, and once we look at it with the Holy Spirit, we realize it's unfounded, the unfounded guilt, which is basically, you know, it didn't happen. No one was harmed in the making of this dream. So,
right.
Thanks again, Lynn, for sharing another hour with me. I always enjoy our conversation.
Absolutely, and I do too, and looking forward to seeing you again next week.
As long as
we believe in time.
With this little teeny fragment.
And this little small barrier of tiny dust and cat hair.
which I just pulled from my sweatshirt as you were saying that.
All right. I love you, Bruce. Thank you so much.
Have a great week, all.
All right. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye for now.
Letting go of this mic for you, Carrie, and Iris.